On the spot? I'm no storyteller, Lyra says. Just an outright liar, then. I press my fingers to my temples. That's enough, Kai. It'll be enough when we leave her stranded here like we planned. Plans change, Lyra says. Let's get one thing straight, Kai tells her. If you think that just because you've manipulated your way into this mission that it means you're part of our crew, then you're wrong. And as long as you're on the side, there's not a step you're going to take that I won't be watching, especially if it's near Elian. So put just one foot wrong, and it'll land you back in that cage. Kai, I warn. Lyra clenches the corner of the table, looking about ready to come undone. Are you threatening me right now? She asks. Nobody's threatening anyone, I say. Kai throws his deck down. Actually, that's exactly what I was doing. Well, great, I tell him. Now that you've let her in on the fact that you're my hired protection, maybe you can be quiet for 5 seconds so I can ask her a question. I turn back to my glaring new crew member, ignoring the irritation on Kai's face. What did you mean, enslave humans in the same way? I ask. Lyra releases her grip on the table and turns her stony eyes from Kai. Sirens are not a free species, she says. Are you trying to tell me that they're just misunderstood? No, wait, let me guess. They actually love humans and want to be one of us, but the Sea Queen has them under mind control. Lyra doesn't blink at my sarcasm. Better to be a loyal warrior than a treacherous prisoner, she says. So once I kill the Sea Queen, they can hunt me of their own free will, I say. That's great. How are you even going to navigate up the cloud mountain of Pagos to get to the Eye? Lyra asks. We, I correct her. You wanted in on this, remember? She sighs. The stories say that only the Pagese royal family can climb it. She eyes me skeptically. You may be royal, but you're not Pagese. Thanks for noticing. I slide more red coins into the center of the table, and Torek throws his hands up. Damn you all! He relents, folding his cards over in a dramatic declaration. Sweep my deck! I grin and slip two of his cards into my own deck. One that I want, and another that I want them to think I do. I split the rest between Kai and Madrid, and they don't hesitate to shoot me disparaging looks at having ruined their hands. I have a map, I tell Lyra. A map, she repeats. There's a secret route up the mountains that will shave weeks off our journey. There are even rest sites with technology to build quick fires to stop the cold. It shouldn't be a problem. Lyra nods, slow and calculating, as though she's trying to piece together a puzzle I haven't given her. How did you get the map? She asks. My charm. No, really. I'm really very charming, I say. I even roped this lot into sacrificing their lives for me. Didn't do it for you. Madrid doesn't look up from her deck. Did it for the target practice. I did it for the hijinks of near-death experiences, Kai says. I did it for more fish suppers. Torek stretches his arms out in a yawn. God knows we don't have enough fish every other day of the year. I turn to Lyra. See? Okay, Prince Charming, she says. Whatever it is, I'm sure it'll come around to bite you later on. I'd rather enjoy that then than hear it now. Ever the cynic. Ever the pirate, she retorts. You say that like it's an insult. You should assume, she says, that everything I say to you is an insult. One day the world is going to run out of luck to give to you. She folds her arms over her chest, and I paint on my most arrogant smile, like I'm daring the world and fate along with it to catch up with me. Even though I know it will someday. I can't let anyone else see that. Either things fall into place, or they fall apart. But either way, I have to keep up pretenses.
22. Lyra. Kalia's face is haunting me. I picture her on the edge of Rioma Putoder, head bowed as she tried to hide her wounds. Ashamed that I'd see the pain my mother inflicted on her in my absence, I can taste it like a sickness in my mouth. Kalia's anguish lingers at the back of my throat the same way it did on the day I held Christelle's heart in my hand. I prowl the deck, watching the crew settle into their routines. They laugh as they scout the water and play cards as they load their guns. All of them seem so at peace. No hidden aches for home behind their eyes. It's as if they don't mind being ripped from their kingdoms over and over, while I miss mine more each day. How can they claim a nomad home so easily? You're thinking too much, Madrid says, settling beside me. I'm making up for the people on this ship who don't think at all. Madrid hooks her arm around a cobweb of rope and swings herself onto the ledge of the ship. Her feet dangle off the edge as the sod glides forward. If you're talking about Kai, she says, then we can agree on that. You don't like him? I press my palms flat on the edge of the ship. Aren't you mates? Mates? Madrid gapes. What are we, horses? We're partners, she says. There's a big difference, you know. The truth is, I don't. When it comes to relationships, I don't know much at all. In my kingdom, there's no time to get to know someone or form a bond. Humans speak of making love, but sirens are nothing if not regimented. We make love the same way we make war. In the ocean, there are only mermen. Most serve as guards to my mother, protecting the sea kingdom of Quito. They are the strongest warriors of us all. Vicious and deadly creatures, more vile than their mermaid counterparts. More brutal than me. Unlike sirens, mermen have no connection to humanity. Sirens look like humans, so there's a part of us that's connected to them. Or perhaps they look like us. We're born half of sea and half of them. And sometimes I wonder if that's where our hatred really comes from. Mermen don't have this problem. They're crafted more from the ocean than any of us, made from the most deadly mixes of fish, with tails of sharks and sea monsters. They have no desire to interact with land, even for the purpose of war. They exist always under the sea, where they are either solitary and disciplined soldiers of the guard, or rampant creatures who live wild on the outskirts of the ocean. Under order of the Sea Queen, these are the creatures we mate with. Before I was thrown into this curse, I was promised to the Flesh Eater. Mermen have no time for names and other nonsenses, and so we call them as they are. Phantom, Skinner, Flesh Eater. While mermaids are fish through and through, laying eggs to be fertilized outside of their bodies, sirens are not as lucky. We must mate. And it's the brutality and savagery of the mermen that make them a worthy combination to create more of our murderous race. At least, that's what my mother says. I'm glad the captain agreed to let you stay, Madrid says. I shake the thoughts of home and look at her questioningly. Why would you be glad? We need to start outnumbering them. Who? The men, she says. Ever since we pulled down to Skeleton Crew, there's been too much testosterone aboard. It seems safer to have a full crew for this mission. She shrugs. The captain didn't want to risk them. Or he couldn't trust them. Madrid heaves herself back onto the ship's deck, her fairy-like boots stomping against the wood grain. He trusts us all. There is something defensive in her voice, and her eyes narrow ever so slightly. Are you upset? I ask, raising an eyebrow. Humans are so sensitive. No, Madrid says. You just shouldn't say things like that. Someone might hear. Like who? Kai? Because he and Elian are good friends? We're all good friends. Madrid throws her hands in the air. Quit doing that. I'm not doing anything. You're trying to meddle. It seems like such a silly thing to be accused of in the grand scheme of things. I'm plotting to steal back my birthright, betray my mother, and then rip out Elian's heart so no human can be a worthy threat to us. Yet somehow Madrid thinks my comments on her friendships are troublesome. Will they have a word for what I'll be when I turn on them? What are you talking about? Kai asks, stepping out from the cabin below decks. He looks at me with a mix of mistrust and curiosity. It's a drastic change from the carefree rapport he shares with everyone else aboard the Sod. If there's anyone on the ship I failed to convince of my usefulness, then it's Elian's pseudo-bodyguard. I could leak every bit of information I have on the Sea Queen. I could even tell him where the Diavolos Sea is. And Kai still wouldn't think I'm worth keeping around. His earlier threats in Idilio play in my mind. He looks at me like he's just waiting for me to slip up and reveal any number of things he could use to sway Elian further into the notion that I can't be trusted. Whether it's on this ship or in my mother's ocean, there never seems to be a time when I don't have to prove myself or worry that anything I do could lead to my downfall. Apparently, I'm a meddler, I tell Kai. Madrid snorts. At least she's open to criticism. Good, Kai says. I have a lot of that to go around. Speaking of things to go around, Madrid looks at my dress with a grimace. Don't you want to change your clothes sometime soon? You can't honestly want to be stuck in that thing for the rest of the trip. It isn't a trip, Kai says. It's a sacred quest to save the world and destroy the Sea Queen, and we shouldn't be bringing along stragglers. Madrid nods. Sure, she says. But we also shouldn't be making Lyra wear my cleaning rag. I finger the hem of the white dress. It's fraying toward the bottom, string peeling from the fabric like skin. The material isn't so much white anymore as it is a muted gray, thick with the charcoal of smoke and grime that I don't want to imagine the origin of. She can dress herself, Kai mutters. His eyes cascade over the wrinkled dress to the shabby ends of my red hair. If you were planning something, though, he says, start by giving her a shower. A shower, I repeat. He sighs. Warm water and soap? I'm assuming they have that where you're from. Madrid tugs her shirt sleeves up to her elbows, revealing sundials and poetry painted onto every inch of her skin. The tattoos on her hands and face are simple enough, but there's no mistaking the ones that circle her arms, past her elbows, and probably winding over her shoulders, too. The mark of Clefthesis pirates, killers by trade. Though I assumed she was from Clefthes, I never dreamed Elian would choose an assassin to be on his crew. For a man who denies being at war, he certainly picks his soldiers well. Madrid nudges me and lowers her voice. The water isn't warm, she says, but Kai wasn't lying about the soap. It beats jumping in the ocean, Kai argues. Unless you want me to fashion a new plank? No, I say. We'll save that for the next time you threaten me. He scowls. If the captain wasn't watching, I really would pitch you overboard. I roll my eyes and look over to the upper deck, where Tarek is currently steering the ship. Elian leans on the railings beside his first mate. The same railings I was tied to. His hat hangs low over the shadows of his eyes, stance loose and casual. His left foot is hooked behind his right and his arms crisscross over his chest. But even I can recognize the difference between appearing relaxed and actually being so. It's the mark of a true killer, to never show the fire within. He watches us with hawk eyes, glancing back to Tarek every now and again to continue their conversation. Mostly he talks with me in his sights. He makes no qualms about surveying me because he clearly wants me to know that my every move is being watched. I'm not trusted. And Elian doesn't want me to forget that. It's smart, if not a little annoying. But the more he watches me and sees that I'm not doing anything, the more complacent he'll get. And eventually, he'll forget to look at all. Eventually, he'll trust me enough that he won't think he needs to. He doesn't care that I can see him, I say. It's his ship, Kai says. Aren't I a guest? You're not a prisoner. I don't miss the disappointment in his voice. For some reason, this makes me laugh. He's going to get bored watching me all the time. Madrid frowns, lines creasing through her tattoos. The captain doesn't get bored, she says. It's not in his bones. I take in a long, cold breath and look back at the water. What's our next destination? Samatta, Kai says. The land of untruth. Something you're familiar with? He asks, and Madrid smacks him on the shoulder. Actually, my mother made me learn about most of the kingdoms, I answer truthfully. She thought it would be useful for me to know about my... I stop short before the word pray leaves my lips. About history. What did you learn? Kai asks. I cast a quick glance over my shoulder to Elian, who reclines farther against the railings, pitching his elbows onto the wood. Enough. And how many languages do you speak? I eye Kai carefully, aware that this is starting to sound like an interrogation. Not many. There was never a reason for me to learn more than my Dacin and a few other lingering dialects common throughout the kingdoms. My own language, for all its jagged edges, more than sufficed. Really, I could have chosen not to speak my Dacin at all. There are many sirens who don't learn the language, even if it's so widely used in the human world. Our songs steal hearts no matter what tongue they're in. Still, I feel lucky knowing such things now. If I hadn't, the prince would have killed me as soon as I opened my mouth. A human who can only speak Saurine is not exactly the best disguise. The captain speaks 15 languages, Madrid says admiringly. Don't forget to wipe the drool off your shoulder, Kai points to her arm. Right there. Madrid slaps his hand away. I meant that it's impressive because I only know 2. Right, he says. Of course you did. Why would anyone want to know 15 languages when most of the world speaks my Dacin? I ask. Don't let the cap hear you say that, Madrid warns. He's all for preserving culture. She says the last bit with a roll of her eyes, as though there's nothing she would like more than to watch her own culture wither to flames. He studied in Glossa, but in the end he realized nobody can master every language, except one of their royals. Lyra doesn't need a backstory of the captain's life, Kai says guardedly. Not when she could be trying on something that doesn't stink of weapon grease. Madrid smiles. Right, she says and snaps her fingers at me. How do you feel about something a little bolder? Bolder? I hesitate, and the beginnings of a smile drift over Madrid's warrior features. Don't panic, she says. I just mean far less damsel and far more buccaneer. I nod slowly. I couldn't care less what she dresses me in, so long as it warms my fragile bones, because right now the cold is pressing against them with the weight of 100 sirens. I dare another look at Elian. His hat shields his eyes from the midday sun, but I can still feel them on me, watching, waiting, for me to slip up and reveal my true intentions, or just maybe for me to do something to earn his loyalty. Let him watch. If Madrid has her way, the next time he sees me, I'll be as much of a pirate as he is.
23. Elian. I don't realize how restless I am until Lyra emerges from below the forecastle deck, dressed in everything but a peg leg. The crew is humming something soft and off-kilter while Kai speaks animatedly with Torek about old debts dying hard. Yet there's silence when we see her. Lyra's hair is pulled to one side in sweeping strands, with braided string running through odd sections. Large gold hoops hang from her ears, stretching her lobes. Even from the quarterdeck, I can see the dried blood around the loops. She is dressed in a pair of dark teal trousers with an ornate jacket to match, ridged by oval button twists. Her shoulders are a flourish of gold tassels, and the ends of a white dress shirt poke out from her wrists. There are patches on her elbows, hastily stitched together with black string. Lyra places a hand on her hip and tries to pretend she doesn't feel self-conscious, but it's the first true thing I've seen on her face since we met. She may look like a pirate, but she's got a way to go before she can pass for one. You've got to be kidding me, Kai says. I told Madrid to give her a shower, not dress her up like a pirate princess. It's sweet that you think she looks like a princess, I say. I'll be sure to tell her that later. I'm serious, Kai tells me, like I couldn't have worked that one out for myself. First, she weasels her way onto the ship, and now she's even trying to look like one of us. It's like she wants us to forget that she's an outsider, so we'll turn our backs on her. You're getting an awful lot of conspiracy from a dress shirt and a new pair of boots. Don't be naive, Kai says. You know better than to trust strangers. I half smile, grinding my teeth together. Advising me to be cautious is one thing, but lecturing me on the deck of my own ship like I'm a child is another altogether. Naive. The word is too familiar not to get under my skin. You sound like my father, I say. If I want a lecture, I'll ask for one. I'm trying to give you some advice. You're trying to second-guess me, and it's getting old, fast. I sigh, feeling the tiredness creep back in. The one usually reserved for my trips to Midas. I'm not some novice setting sail for the first time, I tell him. I'm the captain of this ship, and I'd appreciate it if you stopped treating me like an inexperienced little prince who needs to be advised. Kai's shoulders go rigid, but I'm too frustrated to care about the way his face blankets over in practiced calm. On this ship, I'm not supposed to be a Medasian royal with a legion of bodyguards and councils. I'm supposed to be a damn pirate. It's times like this I'm reminded of the bargain my father offered him. To stay by my side as a guardian rather than a friend. Protecting me from the world I'm eager to explore. Even if Kai denies that's why he's here, having him doubt my decisions and question my moves just makes me think of my father and his court. It reminds me that Kai's a diplomat's son, used to handling royals. And I'm just another prince. getting adventure out of my system before I become king. I slide down the ladder and onto the main deck. Lyra has a gun holster attached to her thigh, above the folds of her knee-length boots. From the red fabric belt that clinches her waist, there's also a golden cuff just big enough to pull a sword through. Thankfully, Madrid didn't give her the weapons to match. "You almost blend in," I say. Lyra's nose crinkles. "That's not a compliment." I pull off my hat and step toward my sword, which rests against the ladder. It's a saber that begins in strong gold and fades to ashen black. The handle is an elaborate cuff with a map of Midas swirled into the metal, and the blade itself curves up ever so slightly at the tip for the most deadly strike. I point the weapon at Madrid and say, "Lend Lyra something." I ask Madrid because she's more attached to her spear gun than anything else, and because I know the rest of the crew would be hesitant to oblige. Trying to separate a pirate from his sword doesn't bear thinking about. "Elian?" Kai's voice gives me pause. It's a warning not to do anything stupid or reckless, especially if it's only to prove a point. "Madrid," I say, gesturing to her cutlass. She hands it over without pause, deliberately avoiding a glance in Kai's direction. She's eager to see what will happen, just as the rest of my crew is. I can feel their eyes circling us, hearing the quiet as their voices drift off and they stop singing to take in the sight. "I didn't realize you could smile," I say as Lyra studies her new blade. "You're going to teach me how to fight?" It isn't a question any more than it's a request. She's demanding it, as though I haven't so much as offered, and it's her feminine charm that spurred this whole thing on. As though she has any sort of charm. I don't make a habit of teaching strangers my tricks, but if Lyra's going to survive among my crew, then she's going to need to know how to carry a blade. Watching her grapple with the guard in Idilio was embarrassing enough, and I need her if I'm going to be able to take down the Sea Queen. Lyra isn't going to offer any of her secrets, not the intimate details of the ritual or any other nuances, until we reach the mountain peak. Which means I need her alive and able to defend herself if I'm not there. Especially when we arrive at our destination. If Lyra thinks my crew is rough around the edges, then she's going to be in for a shock when she meets the Zafra. "I'm going to teach you how to survive," I correct. "First lesson being, don't stand like that." I gesture to her feet, which are pressed closely together, knees as straight as nails. If Lyra really was telling the truth about her family, then I'd expect her to know better. Warriors from Polymystis are nothing if not natural mercenaries. But then she said her family died when she was just a child, and that could mean she was too young to be properly coached. I adjust my position, and Lyra widens her stance to match. She's like a mirror, even raising her arm to mimic the bend in my elbow. "If I beat you, what do I win?" she asks. "The ability to defend yourself." Her smile is lethal. "And if I kill you?" False confidence is nobody's friend. I school in a faultless echo of my father's voice. And then, I attack. Lyra swoops her sword up in a high arc, blocking my first blow. She's quick, but uncertain. Her feet are clumsy, and when she sidesteps, her knees knock against each other. She doesn't seem used to walking, let alone having the right footwork for a duel. I swing again, slower and softer than before. Our swords clink together. I twist away and bring my sword above my head, giving Lyra an opening to attack. She doesn't hesitate. Her blade comes down on mine, hard. If she's not going to win by skill, she's going to do it with brute force. Never mind that I'm actually trying to teach her something. All she wants to learn is how to win. I crouch down and sweep my foot under hers, but she jumps at the last minute and I miss. "That's good," I say. How did you know I was going to do that?
You're highly predictable.
I roll my eyes. Stop retreating, then. When I attack, it's your job to get me on the defensive. Always switch your position so your opponent needs to be the one to get away.
Wars aren't won by running, she says.
You can't win a war, I tell her. Someone else just loses. Lyra's sword wavers, and a look of confusion passes over her severe features. Like she expected another kind of reply from the siren-slaying prince. When she doesn't speak, I point my sword at her, uneasy with the lingering silence. Attack me, I say.
She lurches forward with enough power that our blades smash against each other.
The noise ricochets on long after I step away.
Lyra strikes again, repeatedly, and with no real purpose other than to do any kind of harm.
It's the same misguided mistake that all novices make, attacking with no goal but death.
Have a purpose, I tell her, blocking another attempt.
Lyra's breath is quick and heavy.
What does that mean?
You have to decide what you want, what's going to cause the most harm, and how you can achieve it. You have to think before you attack.
I press forward and Lyra withdraws, then steps toward me, her feet jabbing and dancing across the deck.
It's not exactly graceful, but it's better. At the very least, she's a fast learner. I bring my arm down on hers harder this time, a little more force with each blow until I can see her arms begin to falter. Just when I think her sword is going to drop, she twists to the side and brings her left elbow up.
I block it just in time, inches before my nose is shattered.
She's adapting, using whatever she has to win. It would be admirable if it wasn't so shrewd. I push Lyra away and she falls to the floor with a grunt. She flips onto her back, elbows digging into the wood of the deck, and lets out a long breath.
Gallantry is not your strong point, she says.
I'll remember that the next time you're drowning.
I wasn't drowning.
Lyra heaves herself off the floor.
I can't drown.
No, I say. You can't swim. She glowers and then raises her sword, gesturing for me to do the same. I'm more than happy to oblige. It seems I can get under her skin after all.
Lyra pierces the blade forward, aiming for my heart.
I jump out of the way and slam the handle of my sword into her stomach. She stutters back, but her teeth are ground together. There's no scream or sign of pain aside from the devilish flicker in her eyes. I think about stopping, but I don't have the chance before she's surging toward me once more. She throws her weight into the next blow, and I struggle to bring my sword up fast enough. It's unexpected, and I take a moment too long to process it, giving Lyra the perfect opening. Her fist cracks against my cheek. The pain is intense but fleeting, and Lyra blinks, surprised at herself. I'm less shocked at her for taking the opening than I am at myself for giving it. I kick my legs up, sending Lyra's sword flying across the deck. She tries to copy the gesture, aligning her foot directly with my heart, but she can't keep her balance, and as soon as her ankle is in the air, I grab it and twist. She whirls over and crashes onto her hip. I take a step toward her. Her palms are flat on the deck. But when she sees me nearing, her head whips up and she curls her leg out. I feel my feet being swept out from under me, but catch myself before I slam beside her. I step back and Lyra pounces to her feet again. We eye each other like hunter and prey. And I cock an eyebrow, daring her to move toward me. Lyra smiles impishly in return and picks up her fallen weapon. We continue on that way, swords arcing through the air, our breath ragged. Soon there's sun in the distance, or perhaps even moonlight. Everything is muted, and as Lyra swoops her blade down on mine once more, I let it all fall away. My mission, my kingdom, the world. They exist somewhere other than in this moment. And now there is only this. Me, my ship, and a girl with oceans in her eyes.
24. Lyra. I hum in sync with the ocean. One hand hitched to the empty sword loop on my waist, and the other closing over the edge of the sod. Night quilts the sky with stars sewn like the uneven stitching of my jacket. A new land lies somewhere in reach, the next plotted point in Elian's quest, and the crew sleeps peacefully below while we sail toward it. Above where I linger, the ship's wheel stands firm, twitching ever so slightly to steer the sod onward. Even without a pirate awake to command it, Elian's mighty vessel navigates knowingly along his chosen course. I fasten my jacket over my chest as the wind picks up speed and quicken my song to match the pace. It's an odd sensation to be able to sing and have nobody suffer a consequence for it. To use my voice in the complete opposite way it was intended, with neither death nor sorrow in its wake. Leaving behind nothing but a melody, I feel at peace. There's something about the easy routine of the sod that settles the awful parts holding true inside my heart. Nights are spent taking in the uncanny tranquility of the ocean, far from my mother's wrath. And the crew, even Kai, who isn't at all afraid to be entirely unwelcoming, offers a unique comfort. The easy rapport they share reminds me of home, of Kalia. They look at Elian the same way my cousin looks at me, with devotion that isn't offered in blind fidelity, but earned through something far deeper. Trust, friendship, maybe even love. At the very least, I can pretend not to be my mother's daughter. Live like I've never killed. And spend hours of a day without worrying that everything I do might be used against me. I can almost see why Elian chose to abandon his birthright in favor of such a nomadic life. Though I plan to return to the Diavolos Sea and take my mother's place, I can't deny the appeal of a life spent far from the weight of kingdoms. It definitely isn't the worst idea the prince has had. Most likely. At least he knows what he wants. My mother's voice boomerangs inside my mind, commanding me to give up the hope of trying to overthrow her and just take Elian's heart before it's too late. If I fail at getting the second eye of Quito, then not only will I die, but I'll die a traitor to the ocean. But what's the alternative? Bowing and praying that one day she gives me the throne, all the while watching Kalia wince in her presence. If I follow my mother's orders, then I'm condemning Kalia and the rest of the ocean to her rule. But if I don't follow them, if I dare to go through with my plot, then I risk proving just how defective I really am. I grip the ship more tightly, inhaling the slick salt in the air. If only my quest were as simple as Elian's, singularly focused on being the savior of humanity. It might seem like a big undertaking, but it's not like it requires him to betray everything he's ever known. If he succeeds, his mother might be proud. If I succeed, mine might die. Thinking of Elian makes the night seem colder. I know whichever plan I go with will lead to his death. Either I try to kill him now, or I wait to kill him after. But there's no path I've mapped out for myself that doesn't end alongside his life. Every action will betray. Every choice will slaughter. Despite what my mother says, I seem to be the exact kind of monster she wanted. The very moment I think that, a soft melody slips through the air. A distant lullaby. Too far to make out, but familiar all the same. It's drowsing and seductive, So much so that it takes me a few moments to realize the ship is quaking. It's like the ocean hears the treachery of my thoughts and sends a mighty force crashing into the side of the sod. I hurl forward and my hands slam over the edge of the ship's body. I barely stop myself from plummeting overboard. I hold back a scream and look down at the peaceful ocean below. There's not a wave in sight, or the slow bubble of froth that comes after such a powerful surge. But there is a shadow. I blink. It lingers in the pooling darkness, half swallowed by water and gripping firmly onto the sod. I squint, leaning farther over the edge to get a closer look. From the darkness, a skeleton claw rises. The shadow scrambles toward me, scurrying up the side of the sod with nefarious speed. I jump back just in time for the creature to pounce onto the deck and shake the sails. Ridges crisscross down its body like scars, patched by motes of gray that seep into its flesh. Each of its fins are set apart in razors, and its large torso is carved into endless folds, leading to arms that end in inky talons. Half shark, half something far more demonic. The Flesh Eater. I drop to my knees, and my mother's monster roars. He skitters toward me, reaching out with slick palms to drag a hand down my cheek.
Por Nemo.
He gnarls. I don't react to the possessive claim or the repulsive way he phrases it. His claws scraped against my skin in warning. I was wary of the Flesh Eater, even when I was a siren. But now that I'm human, he could easily tear through me. Perhaps that's why my mother sent him. I wonder why Elian and his crew haven't come running. Is it possible they didn't feel the ship lurch? I focus again on that familiar lullaby gliding through the wind, making my eyes heavier with each verse. A siren's song. Making sure the crew stays in their slumber.
Anthropinos!
The Flesh Eater barks. Human. The word croaks from deep within his throat, splintering through the cracks in his fangs. Disgusted. Curious. Perhaps amused if it's possible for mermen to feel something so closely related to joy. The Flesh Eater takes a hold of my chin and jerks my face to his so I can smell the sour blood on his breath. When he slides his viscous lips against mine, I keep deadly still. My teeth grate together. But it's only seconds before I feel flesh crawling along my tongue. I can taste the decay in him. The Flesh Eater rips away from me and spits. He swipes his shark tail in the air and bares his saliva-stringed fangs. He can taste the humanity in me, just as I can taste the demon in him. At his outburst, a call of laughter spills from the ocean, ricocheting off the sod and blowing through her sails. The music climbs, and my heart clinches. My mother's long tentacles spill over the deck like oil, familiar tribal tattoos cutting across her skin. Her crown sits gloriously sharpened, crawling down the length of her back in a magnificent headdress. She grasps the trident and stares at me with eyes like pits.
Don't look so frightened, darling.
The sea queen bares her fangs to a smile.
Mother's here.
I pull myself up from my knees and stare hard at the floor to give the appearance of bowing. The longer I glare at the wood grain, the more my skin heats, sweat pasting through my clothes as the anger boils beneath. I can hardly bear the thought of looking at her. After everything she's done, For her to show up here, on Elian's ship of all places, is the worst kind of insult. A terse silence gathers between us, and for a moment I wonder what the next sound will be. The flesh-eater's roar, my mother's laughter, the erratic pounding of my furious heart. Instead, I hear my song. The deadly lullaby from before grows louder, and I snap my head up in sudden recognition, stumbling backward. It crawls across the deck, reaching out with delicate hands to sway the sod. The melody is as opiate as ever, and even I'm barely able to keep my footing as it grows. Hearing it feels like being lost in a memory or a dream that's impossible to wake from. It feels like being born into a world imagined. With the lie of my song, there's no chance any of the crew will wake from their sleep. My mother presses a long, webbed finger to her chest, and her seashell flickers against my voice. When my eyes begin to fog, her mouth tugs up. "It's only a keepsake," she says. "I'll return it if you succeed." I try desperately to blink the sorrow from my eyes. "Have you come to taunt me?" I ask. "Not at all," the Sea Queen says. "I've come to see how the Prince's bane is faring." She arches her neck. "Do you have the Prince's heart hidden somewhere in those unsightly rags?" It doesn't surprise me that she's come to check if I'm sticking to her plan. Being punished and pushed in the exact direction she's plotted. Like Elian's ship following his course even while the captain sleeps. I am my mother's vessel, or so she thinks. "It's not that simple," I say. "Oh, Lyra." She swipes a string of seaweed from her trident. "Queens do not make excuses. I suppose this is just further proof of why you can't become one." "I deserve to be queen," I say. "I'm strong enough to lead our kind."
"You're weak," she accuses. "You've always been weak. Look at you now, dressed in your human clothes, with your human emotions."
"Do you know what I see in your eyes, Lyra? It's not death or darkness or even anger. It's tears." I swallow. "I don't know what you're talking about."
"I'm talking about the look on your face," she says. "Your human grief."
I want to argue, but even I can't deny the sadness pricking the backs of my eyes. I felt anger as a siren, but never sorrow. Not since I took Crestel's heart with my mother's hand steady on my shoulder. But hearing my song cleave through Elian's ship, knowing that at this very moment my mother is still able to use me as a weapon without my consent, feels like being speared. And the way she looks at me, not at all concerned, so entirely contrasted by the worry I felt when I saw Kalia's wounds, or that Kai had when Maeve attacked Elian, or even the look on the prince's face when he pulled me from the ocean my mother left me to drown in. How can the Sea Queen see it as a weakness when it's the very thing that binds the humans together, ensuring their strength as a unit, a family? The flesh-eater snarls, and my mother reaches out to run a talon over his face. She slices a line across his cheek, slowly, soothingly, and the flesh-eater growls in satisfaction.
"Your time is running out, Lyra," she says, bringing her finger to her lips. "And if you don't bring me the prince's heart soon, then I'm going to take yours."
25. Lyra. When I look in the mirror, a stranger stares back. She takes in my newfound piracy and my newfound humanity.
the face the flesh-eater still claimed for his own, and frowns in a way that marks her innocent features with a curious dent deep in the center of her brows. Her lips thin, and she roughly irons the wrinkle out with the palm of her hand. My skin is flushed red from sun, and my hair is stiff with the saltwater breeze. I step forward and touch the glass with spiny fingers, blinking rapidly as I take in this version of myself. Legs and feet. Eyes, each the same color. A human heart beating somewhere underneath it all, ready for my mother to take. In the reflection, I see Elian. He stands behind me with an amused expression, leaning against the doorway, his arms tangled over his chest. He doesn't say anything, and we continue to watch each other through the pathway of glass, until an odd feeling washes over me, worse than dread. Soon we'll be in Samatta, and that means Pagos won't be far off. Then, the Cloud Mountain. The second eye of Keto. Elian's certain death. Each point of my deception is so seamlessly plotted that I should feel prepared, but I don't. Everyone I'm going to betray is too close. My mother may even be watching, and that means there's a chance she could discover my plan. It feels like a miracle that she didn't smell it on me before, or hear how fast my human heart beat. And then there's Elian, who gave me a blade instead of stabbing me with it, standing behind me now. The mercy he practices and the loyalty he has earned are both ideals that my mother would sooner burn out of me, because mercy is never an option, and loyalty is always taken. But those very emotions my mother said made me weak seem to make him strong. He's a warrior who is my opposite in every way, and yet, in some ways, maybe fierceness alone, we seem to be the same. In the mirror, Elian continues to stare. I frown when I realize that my back is to him. I've never been able to turn my back on my mother before. I spin to face him. What? I ask. Are you done admiring yourself? Never, I say, though truth be told, I'm glad to be distracted from my thoughts. We're about to dock at Samatta. Try to remember what I told you. As though I could forget. What he told me was to lie, which I had enough practice in to not think of it as something that needed to be done, but something that always was. If Samatta is so dangerous, I say, then why are we stopping there? Because we need to get something. I shoot Elian a skeptical look. You mean we need to steal something. Good, he says. You're learning. I follow him out onto the main deck, where the crew is gathered. Kai tucks his sword into the strap across his chest and slips a pistol under his coat. Rather than go to his side, Elian avoids eye contact with his bodyguard, choosing to stay beside me. Kai doesn't move to shadow him either, suddenly preoccupied with adjusting his coat collar. You'd think the land of lies would be a little more forgiving when it came to thievery, Madrid says, but apparently not. I give Elian a scathing look. You stole something last time you were here, I said, and now you're going to do it again? Who said I was the one who stole something the first time? His voice is indignant, which doesn't fool me. I roll my eyes to illustrate this, and Elian sighs. Look, he says, all that matters is that the sod isn't welcome. The sod, I repeat, or you. You say that like there's any sort of difference. I suppose there isn't. I twist my seashell between my fingers. You're both equally dense. Elian laughs. Loudly, monotone, in a way that's nearly as mocking as my comment. Come on, he says. We don't have time for you to learn how to be funny. Samatta is a very peculiar shade of gray. There's color, but it's diluted into an eerie film of black, like a just visible cloud coating the land in a tint of shadow and dust. It reminds me of looking through murky ocean water at twilight, or the feeling of staring straight into my mother's eyes, a darkness that seems ever-present. I rub a knuckle in my eye, and when my vision refocuses, everything seems darker than it was before. The more I try to make the shade disappear, the stronger it gets. It's no wonder this is the land of lies and treachery, with air as gray and smog-like as the scruples of the people who breathe it. The wind sweats as we weave through the streets, avoiding eye contact and the usual noise Elian and his crew enjoy making. Only a dozen of them are with us, the others waiting on the sod. They move like wraiths, floating instead of walking, gliding across the hard stone pavements. I stumble to keep in step with them, nowhere near as graceful, but every bit as invisible. As we make our way across the square, I tip my hat farther down my head. It's ridiculous, I realize, because there isn't a human alive who can recognize me. If anything, I'm the most ghost-like of us all. Still, I do it anyway, thrilled by the slight jump of my heart when someone lingers their stare on our group for too long. When I look to Elian, his face is blank and stoic, but his eyes are nowhere near as dead. They flicker with the same dirty pleasure. It's this, I realize, that draws the crew as much as the ocean, the pleasure of becoming as elusive as they are notorious. We turn into an alleyway where a man waits for us. He's dressed in a long black coat with a white pressed-down collar, and his heavily ringed hand rests upon a cane that is the same sandy shade as his hair. Elian flashes him a smile, and when the man doesn't return it, he flashes him a pouch of coin instead. A toothy grin slides onto the stranger's face, and he presses his palm flat against the gray stone wall. It slides out from under him, drawing back like a curtain. He hands Elian a small key and gestures for us to step inside. Once we do, the wall closes behind us and leaves nothing but shadows in our midst. The torchlight flickers as wisps of air blow through the stone entrance. We hunch together at the foot of a staircase the narrow room can barely contain. I reach up to fiddle with my seashell. The space is too small, and I realize quickly that it's the smallest space I've ever been in. Even the crystal cage seems commodious in comparison. What is this? I ask. Elian casts a glance over his shoulder. Stairs, he says, and begins to climb them. I don't waste good breath on a retort. Staring up at the never-ending spiral, I have a suspicion that I'll need to save it. I can't imagine the climb up the cloud mountain of Pegasus being this arduous. I keep my silence as we ascend, wondering if we'll reach the top before my legs buckle out from under me. But just as it seems I won't be able to take another step, Elian comes to a halt, and a large oak door emerges from the barely there light. This is dramatic, I say, squashing myself into the space beside him. Is someone on the other side going to try to kill us? Since when did you become one of us? Kai asks, and Madrid jerks him in the ribs. He grunts and then says, Fine. I look forward to you laying down your life for mine, comrade. At which point I debate whether or not to push him back down the stairs. I watch Elian pull the key from his pocket and twist it into the slanted lock. When the door pushes open, I expect to be hit with a rush of dust or the smell of dying embers and decay. Instead, I'm hit by light. It flashes away gray and echoes from dozens of sphere-shaped torches that blink with deep yellow flames. The room is large and accommodating enough for a hidden attic, with an alleyway of doors that lead off to separate rooms. A low chandelier slices through the middle, with beads that graze the polished floors. This is not what I expected, I say, taken aback by the misplaced opulence. Elian steps